Welcome to this second part of NMR lecturing the structural biology course. And well, as previous lectures, more or less about some of the basic principles, how the experiments are kind of built and what kind of interactions and observables there are. In NMR, we try now to look at how we actually can use this method for protein structure determination, and then short glimpse of maybe that how we can study the dynamics and the interactions. But of course, the time is very limited to go through all the details, but you will get hopefully some kind of an idea how the and things are done and what it kind of requires. So the next step when we have made our protein, maybe we have already measured the proton spectrum and seen that it is suitable for the structure determination, or at least structural characterization with NMR. And what is the thing that we want to do next is the signal assignment. And there are ways of doing that, and I am describing the signal assignment using so-called heteronuclear NMR experiments. This could be accomplished in a different ways, but I'm just showing here one approach which we are quite often applying, but of course this is not the whole truth as such, but it gives you an idea how the assignment can be achieved. So the basic problem in NMR is to do that we will get the NMR resonances, of course, but then we want to know that which proton or which atom these signals correspond to in the actual molecule. And this is quite easy for in the case of small molecule. Let's take it here like a valine as an example. It has the alpha proton, then it has the beta proton, and these two methyl protons, or the groups, the gamma protons. So based on the peak patterns or the splittings and the chemical shifts we were talking the last lecture, we can quite easily recognize that this is the alpha proton, which is then coupled to so-called beta proton, and the beta proton is further coupled to methyl groups, and then it's relatively easy to recognize, following the basic NMR rules, that which proton corresponds to which frequency or the shift value. And this is because we have the narrow lines and a relatively small amount of peaks in the spectrum. But in the case of, sorry for the resolution of this figure, it's not very good anyway, but maybe it's kind of enforces the presentation kind of. So the dilemma stays here that we should, in case of 176 kilo residue protein calreticulin, we should identify that which peak corresponds to which atom in the molecule, and there are hundreds or thousands of protons in that molecule, and basically each line here is corresponding to one specific proton in that molecule. So now you can understand that it's pretty difficult using this one-dimensional experiment, because the spectral lines are way too broad, and there's a lot of signal overlap. So it's very difficult to find these resonance connectivities through the spin couplings. So to that end, we need to use heteronuclear multidimensional NMR. So very shortly, how we produce the isotopically enriched proteins to carry out these heteronuclear NMR experiments. Well, there's a usual protocol to clone your sequence to the vector that is in for the E. coli expression, and then instead of LV medium, you grow your protein in so-called minimal medium or M9 medium, which is cost effective. Or if you are very rich, you have a lot of project funding, of course, then you can use the rich medium, which is terribly expensive still these days. Anyway, for the M9 medium, you need the N15 labeled ammonium chloride and carbon-13 labeled glucose, which are used as the sole sources of nitrogen and carbon. So there is basically no amino acids available in the M9 medium. Typically, the expression levels drops a bit or a lot, depending on your protein. Anyway, you can for the 1 liter or 2 liter culture, the costs are not excessive, especially if one thinks about the N15 label. The purification is anyway vital, like it's in for the crystallography as well, but you can use different kind of tags and so like GST or Sumo tag or GT1 his tag, but if the tag is very large, like the GST or GB1 even, which is a protein anyway, you have to cleave out, or most likely you have to clear out the tag using some protease like TEV or thrombin. So then you have, let's say, the N15 carbon-13 labeled sample. So why do we need this resonance assignment? Why do we need to identify these peaks? Because the structure calculation is based on the NOE, that is cross relaxation peak intensities. So the peaks are recognized by their chemical shifts. So if we don't know which protons corresponds to which chemical shift, we cannot know that which are these internuclear distances in the NOE spectrum, because we cannot link the right protons to right resonances. So we need to identify these chemical shifts first. And the way to do that is so-called sequential assignment. It tends to be difficult to people to grasp that what is sequential assignment means. It's not the sequencing of the protein. We already know the sequence of the protein, but the sequential assignment means that we need to assign these chemical shifts in our primary structure to the NMR spectrum, or the signals in the NMR spectra. And the first step in this so-called sequential assignment is the connection of spin system. We have the primary structure and we connect the spin systems using certain kind of NMR experiments. Then the next step is to identify these spin systems here. And the spin systems can be identified again using certain kind of NMR experiments, but they are also recognized by the chemical shifts. And then you match the sequence or these residues with the certain stretches within the known amino acid sequence that you can identify that, well, here we have the serine and then we have the glycine and serine and alanine, which are quite easy to recognize. And then you match the remaining residues with the known amino acid sequence. So how this is done in practice, we will soon see. So the spin systems I was referring to is basically the amino acids. So each amino acid forms a unique spin system. So that's why you also need to know the structure of amino acid, really. But I'm not going into details about this naming, not my literature or so, but we start this process anyway by running the establishing the correlations between the amide proton and the nitrogen. And to that end, we use the two-dimensional HSQC experiments, where we transfer the magnetization from proton to nitrogen, pick up the chemical shift of nitrogen in the T1, the first indirectly detected dimension, bring it back to the proton frequency and measure the proton chemical shift in the orthogonal dimension. And that magnetization transfer, we use the scalar coupling of 90 Hertz roughly between the proton and the amide nitrogen. And it gives us a fingerprint spectrum of proteins. Each protein more or less have a unique proton nitrogen correlation spectrum. So here, like for this one enzyme of 144 residues, here on the vertical axis we have the nitrogen chemical shift, and then here on the horizontal axis we have the proton chemical shift. So each amide proton within some particular residue is correlated with the frequency of its nitrogen. In addition to this backbone or the main chain correlation, we will see a number of other correlations which are stemming from arginine side chains, shown here in green, which are folded in into the spectrum, and also this correlated with the vertical lines, which are stemming from the two different protons of side chains connected to the same nitrogen of the asparagine and the glutamine side chains. Of course, because the proline is missing the amide proton, it cannot be detected in this experiment, so we cannot see the prolines. Tryptophan also gives the indole proton in the side chain gives a signal in the spectrum, typically in the characteristic region of 10 ppm on the proton axis or higher, or typically here in the bottom left-hand corner. And then the main chain signals are all the rest here. And the task is to identify which residue this particular signal or that particular signal corresponds to. So next step is to do this assignment, and because now we have the labeled uniformly nitrogen 15 and carbon 13 labeled sample, we can use the so-called triple resonance experiments. It's suitable for proteins up to maybe 50 to 100 kilodaltons if it's also deuterated or so, but this works for proteins less than 30 kilotons pretty nicely, or in a routine way. So we use the specific kind of experiments, especially the HNCACB and the HNCOCACB, and this nomenclature means that the amide proton and the nitrogen frequencies are in three-dimensional space correlated with the C-alpha and C-beta chemical shifts on the carbon side. That's that in essence, so to say. There are, this assignment of proteins are typically accomplished in two or three steps. We first carry out the backbone assignment, which I'm showing here you a couple of examples, and then we can assign typically the second or third step. We omit the second step. We can assign the side chains, the aliphatic side chain, and then the aromatic side chains. But in this lecture series, we are not going into details about them. But this is an additional task that you need to carry out if you want to determine the structure, the denormal structure of a protein using NMR. So the principle of so-called sequential walk, how we can connect the individual residues within the amino acid sequence in the spectrum is based on this triple resonance correlation experiment. So we start the magnetization transfer from amide proton, we transfer it to the nitrogens, and further to the alpha carbons of the residue's own alpha carbon or the alpha carbons of the previous or the preceding residues. So there are like three different frequencies correlated: proton, nitrogen, and then the alpha carbon of the own residue and the previous residue. And then we can use the complementary HNCOCA experiments, which works in a similar fashion, but it goes only to the preceding carbon, alpha carbon. So it gives only correlation for the same amide proton nitrogen frequency, but only correlation to the preceding residues alpha carbon. And of course, this goes through all the amino acid sequence because it's uniformly labeled. So we will get similar correlations for the neighboring residue. And now we can find that there is the same alpha carbon frequency of the preceding or the residue's own alpha carbon here, and in this different frequency of another proton nitrogen part of the following residue, which is now seen as a preceding correlation. So we can see that they divide the same alpha carbon frequency, meaning that these two amino acids are neighbors together. Okay, so the HNCA experiment is like this, just to briefly go through it, that we transfer the magnetization from proton to nitrogen, like in the carbon, in the nitrogen HSQC I was mentioning for the two-dimensional experiment. Then it's further transfer the magnetization from nitrogen to alpha carbon, and we pick the alpha carbon chemical system T1 period, bring the magnetization back to nitrogen, pick up the nitrogen chemical system to T2 period, and finally bring the magnetization back to amide proton and detect the chemical shift of that in the third dimension. So schematic presentation of this experiment now as a three-dimensional cube shows this information content. So we have the proton, nitrogen, and two alpha carbon frequency for one residue. And then we are typically looking these as slices. We take the chemical shift slice at the of the residue which is resonating at the nitrogen frequency of 110 ppm. Then we try to find the matching frequency of that residue, and we find that these alpha carbons are actually matching at the for the residue which is finding, and the nitrogen frequency is 125 ppm. And then we know that these are sequential neighbors, so to say. So we can recapitulate this for the real data in a way to carry out these main steps in the backbone assignment. We first find the peaks, pick up the peaks in the nitrogen 15 HSQC spectrum. Then we start find these same peaks in the three-dimensional spectrum at the position defined by this nitrogen 15 root spectrum. Then we compare these observed peaks with the maximum number of expected peaks for each spectrum. And then we can analyze these three-dimensional experiments. So as I mentioned already, the HNCACB experiment is highly similar to HNCA, but in addition to alpha carbon frequency, there's an additional frequency of beta carbons. It just makes the assignment easier. So for each amide proton nitrogen frequency, we will see the alpha carbons and then the beta carbons. Whereas in the HNCOCACB experiment, we can only see the alpha carbons or the alpha carbons and beta carbons of previous residue or the preceding residue. Then, so we select some spin system and identify the spin system sequential to it. And if we find unique match or the connectivities, we can generate a fragment of these spin systems. So we try to find frequencies that we can find the correlation. This is like a beta carbon chemical shift pathway, and this is like alpha carbon chemical shift pathway. We find the matching frequencies. And when this is done, this can be done pretty automatically, in a way, build these ladders, so to say. Then we assign the fragment on the basis of this chemical shift. And it's easy to identify these residues, especially for the alanine, because the alanine has the methyl group in the beta position. So it's a very characteristic chemical shift. As you can see, there's no other residue showing beta chemical shifts in this frequency range. The glycine doesn't have the beta proton or the carbon, so it's easy to identify also. And serine and threonine, they have the beta carbon at the high frequency, on the frequency which is typical for the alpha carbons, but because of the sign change in the spectrum for the beta carbons with respect to alpha carbons, it's easy to identify these among the alpha carbons. So in this spectrum, we can easily find out, for example, in this HNCACB slice here, that, well, this is a threonine because the beta is here, the green color among the yellow-colored alpha carbons. We can find another residue quite easily. It's just the glycine here. It only have the alpha carbon, but not really beta carbons. That's good. And then we can find another threonine with the characteristic chemical shift for the beta carbon here at the high frequency. Okay, then we can fill rest of the part already if the sequence is quite unique. So if it only contains this kind of motif, like the THR, X glycine, XX THR. And we can find this kind of only one unique match of these kind of sequences. So we can generate the fragment for that already. And then it's possible to identify the rest of the residues just based on these easy residues kind of Then we can start a new fragment if the sequential connectivities are missing or when we cannot go further, and then repeat this assignment procedure until all the spin systems are assigned. And then we can add these frequencies to the root spectrum or the fingerprint spectrum and fill the rest of the gaps remain. And then we have the sequential assignment for the backbone signals already at hand. And at this point, you can start already doing the biology. I mean, if you have the existing structure, whether it's the cryo-EM structure or crystal structure or existing NMR structure, you have already assigned your backbone. I mean, you know that at which part of the molecule in the existing structure in the PDB database where these residues are located in the structure and where they are in the NMR spectrum. If you want to proceed, you don't have the existing structure, for instance, and or you want for some reason to do the structure with your protein. Maybe it's some mutant or whatever you want, or the complete de novo structure. What you can easily do is to get the secondary structure of your protein. Because these alpha carbon, beta carbon, alpha proton and carbonyl carbon chemical shifts are depending on their secondary structure. So in case of fully formed alpha helix, the C alpha carbon and C beta carbon are clearly shifted from their random coil values. 2.5 PPMs, for instance. And for the beta seed structure, there's alpha carbons have been shifting 1.5 PPMs, whereas the beta minus 1.5 and the beta carbon chemical shifts are shifted plus 2 PPMs. So it's quite easy to identify that in which part of the molecule there is which kind of a secondary structure. So for example, like in the case of this one small enzyme from Staphylococcus aureus, you can actually see from the chemical shift directly that where are the beta sheets and where are the alpha helices located. So you just insert these numbers to a database and it gives you pretty nice information already. So the next step from here is to carry out the assignment of aliphatic side chains and aromatic side chains, but we are not going into the principles is more or less the same, and it's relatively straightforward to do mostly if you have this backbone assignment done, but because there's quite a bit of these experiments to go through, I will skip this part, and if you're interested in, you are welcome to the specific protein NMR or a macromolecular NMR course in the spring, where we are going through these experiments in more detail. When you have carried out the assignment, you should be placing your assignments to the NMR data repository, the biological magnetic resonance data bank, where the goal is to archive all NMR-specific data so we can use these data then in the later phase that where are the typical like a phenylalanine chemical shift for certain proton or carbon in that structure, or where is the chemical shift of histidine side chain nitrogen delta or solve. Or you can even simulate the data that the HSQC based on your sequence. How does it could look like in a way? So this is like a mandatory step to carry out if you want to publish your data. It is also possible nowadays when you are doing this to calculate the protein structure based on solely on the backbone chemical shafts. And we actually tested that with one helical protein. Here on the left-hand side, this is based on all the whistles and bells that we have, the distance information and so on. So this is like a de novo NMR structure that we determined for this protein. And then here is the based on the solely on the chemical shift data without any restraints or the distance restraints used for the structure calculation. So in some cases it works pretty nicely, at least from the fold point of view, that you can find the correct folding for your protein. But of course, if you want to do with some enzyme very specific work and see how the side chains are making the contacts and so on, maybe this is not the way to go. But if you just want to see that, how does it look like and whether it's similar to crystal structure, for instance, maybe this is the way to do it. And then you can continue doing the interaction studies with the ligand or so. Anyway, if you want to proceed the structure calculation, calculating the NMR structure, you need some additional restraints, usually. Like most important distance restraints in terms of NOEs and hydrogen bonds. Maybe the scalar J coupling constants that I mentioned for the torsional or the dihedral restraints, residual dipolar couplings I mentioned, and there are numerous restraints that you can use in the structure calculation. We only go through a couple of them here, and the most important of them is the distance restraints in terms of these NOE cross peaks. So when you have assigned your protein, you will now see the cross peaks stemming from this dipolar cross relaxation. So sertine proton, which is close to your amide proton, or let's say alpha carbon or methyl carbon and proton, they will see sertine proton frequencies which are close in space within 5 to 6 angstroms. And then you can build sort of a distance map based on this information. And you basically, or in practice, you put this in the automatic structure calculation program called Cyana as a upper limits that these protons can be at the maximum distance of 3.5 angstroms. And then it builds your structure. And as I mentioned, there are a number of these restraints, but typically one is using for the normal protein or in the routine work only these NOE restraints. In some cases, some additional restraints if you want to do very delicate work or if you want to do, if you cannot rely solely on the NOE distance restraint information. So these are then put into structure calculation as experimental restraints. And it's basically the restraints molecular dynamics simulated annealing. So the goal is to get an ensemble of structure which satisfy all the experimental restraints and represents accurately the full permissible conformational space which these restraints enable, and is high quality enough, I mean that there are proper column geometry and the dihedrals and the bond lengths and stereochemistry is top notch and so on. So what this basically means is that you have these geometrical restraints in terms of bond angles, van der Waals, electrostatics, and then you have this experimental NMR restraints, like the distance information through NOEs, maybe the dihedrals, residual dipolar couplings, and so on. You start from the randomized polypeptide structure, you know the primary structure of your sequence, of course, and then based on these restraints, you minimize the energy, and you will get number of conformers, and the better the internal accuracy or persistence between the conformers is, the lower the RMST, the root mean square deviation between the conformers is. So it's basically just including your polypeptide chain to the distance restraints, maybe dihedrals in terms of coupling information, or orientational restraints in terms of residual dipolar couplings, and then it builds you the model how these experimental restraints are fulfilled. And as I mentioned, this can be achieved using the Sayana program. So the biggest hurdle in the NMR structure determination of proteins used to be the assignment of this NOE spectra, because you need to have the assignment of first of the backbone and the side chain, and then you need to go through all the pieces in the NOE spectra and see that what peak is corresponding to what proton and between which protons this NOE correlation exists. But this Sayana program is doing this automatically, so you basically just pick the peaks in the NOE spectra, and if you have the more or less full assignment, 90 to 95%, it works like a dream in a way that it just builds you the model in a couple of hours, like shown here for this small protein, which can be run in cluster computer in something like half an hour or less. So it starts from this randomized structure, then it goes through the cycles and ends up being in the final conformation, where the RMST can be relatively low of the backbone atoms, for instance. In case of calorimetry that we did already, the structure calculation 17 years ago, we collected, somebody was asking that this after the first lecture, that how many spectra we collected, and this is the number of spectra, all the spectra that we basically collected to determine the structure of this. We could typically leave out, let's say, this part here. Nowadays, this is not routinely applied anymore, this, because we measure the number of these residual dipolar couplings and the J coupling information. So it's basically these two NOE experiments and then the assignment of the main chain and side chain. So something like 10 spectrum or so altogether. Okay, so next part, I would like to go, let's say, beyond the structure determination, because I mentioned that NMR is a very versatile tool for biomolecular studies. That it's a very versatile biophysical tool. It's not only determine the structures actually the NMR is not maybe for the sole structure determination, it takes some time, especially if the protein is large. It's relatively quite a bit of work, but the fun part often starts after you have been assigning your protein, or you are not determining the structure. Such, of course, that can be fun too, but I mean, the real power of NMR comes from this looking at the, for example, the protein ligand interactions, or studying the protein dynamics, or some interesting details that you can monitor when you have your assignments, or you know which residues are involved, or the which side chains are involved to some, let's say, reaction or conformational chains or whatever you are trying to probe. So let's have a look about something about, in a very superficial level, about the protein dynamics. So as I mentioned in the first slide, that the good targets for NMR nowadays are even the modular proteins, which has these mobile linkers. So there is quite a bit of flexibility or dynamics involved. Also, even in the membrane proteins, those parts which are outside the membrane can be very important for the function of that protein, and they also involve quite a bit of dynamics. And of course, an extreme example of this dynamics is these partially folded or intrinsically disordered proteins, which can go through various timescales in dynamics, either alone or with their binding partner in solution. So the molecules and molecular interactions, as we know, they are not static. So they display dynamics at various timescales and varying amplitudes. Protein function, as we know, is often connected to this dynamics, because there is some conformational change or something dynamical going on that the protein is actually working. So here in the bottom part of the slide, you can see three views for the same complex structure. The complex shown here is the small SH3 domain of protein called amphifusin, which is involved in membrane trafficking or recruiting proteins for example, endocytosis or so, and it's targeted by some pathogens, and so the here on the right hand side we see as a surface model, we see the SH3 domain structure, and then the blue stick model here is the peptide, or the part of the peptide or a protein, non-structural protein from the chikungunya virus. And the chikungunya virus is the one that is causing you quite a bit of muscle and joint pain, which can in some cases it can last months or even years. So there are not very much deaths involved to this disease, or although some deaths are known. There has been some outbreaks of this chikungunya virus, but anyway, it's a quite nasty virus to get. So, but this NS, this non-structural protein 3 is targeting this SH3 domain of amphiphysin, and you can see from this right-hand side image or figure that this looks like pretty nice structure. It's kind of a good presentation of the structure. But if, and the same holds true also here in the mid part. But then if you are looking this left hand side here, it's where are superimposed number of these conformers. Whereas in the B and C panel, we can see only one conformer. But in the case of panel A, we can see 20 conformers superimposed. And we can see that many parts of this, especially if we are focusing now on this peptide here, we can see that for many parts, it's nicely superimposable, the prolines here and the arginines going to the classical specificity pocket here. They are pretty nicely defined, but these two arginines here at the C-terminus are clearly like blurred, or their orientation is not the same. It's kind of fluctuating between the conformers. So is this related to dynamics, or is it just a number of lacking of number of restraints? The dynamical studies with the NMR can reveal that thing. We can have a look about it a bit. So basically, the NMR provides site-specifically information about rotational diffusion, how fast our molecule is tumbling into solution. And it determines mostly the T2 relaxation time and indirectly to the line width we are getting. The longer the correlation time, the slower the tumbling, and sort of the relaxation times and the broader the line width. Then it also can give you information about the translational diffusion using this dosy experiments I was talking at the very end for the previous lecture. So how fast this molecule move from one place to another. So it's basically also connected to the shape and the size of the molecule or the complex. Then we have this degree of order for the backbone and also side chain atoms, like the S square value. We will soon talk about it a bit more. Then it also gives you information about the internal dynamics of the backbone and side chains, the fast movements in a way. And one of the most important information is the conformational and chemical exchange I was talking about last lecture also, the slow dynamics, typically micromillisecond timescale dynamics. And then finally, it also gives you about information about the kinetic parameters of the molecular interactions in a way that what is the K on, K off in a way to what is the KD of binding. So if we connect these now to some molecular motions or biological events on a protein scale, we can see that on a time scale, in an NMR time scale, pick a nanosecond time scale dynamics, which we can probe with this T1, T2, and so called heteronuclear NOE measurements, we can see that how fast is the fast loop orientation and side chain rotation, taking place, or the backbone dynamics, is in this time scale, what we are talking about. Then, if we are going to the micromillisecond time scale, there are the slower loop reorientation, the enzyme kinetics, ligand binding, and slow domain movements, which can be probed then by this so-called Carl-Purcell Maybaum-Gell NMR sequence. The radio frequency field can be changed accordingly to probe that on what time scale these motions take place. And then on the relatively slow time scale, we are talking about the protein folding things that we can then study with the chemical exchange or the exchange spectroscopy of the proton-deuterium exchange experiment. But there is quite a bit of NMR experiments which you can apply or employ to study dynamics at the different time scales. So if we look at very kind of a crude information without really analyzing data very much, we can see the dynamics between two different proteins. These are called clactosin and C-terminal domain of twinfilin, which are both binding the actin. Twinfilin is binding both monomeric and filamentous form of actin, whereas clactosin is known to bind only filamentous form of actin and relatively the weak affinity. So if we just measure the dynamics, the T2, how fast the signal is decaying, if we are measuring that along the amino acid sequence, we can see that in case of twinfilin, it looks like pretty flat. There are, of course, some changes, especially in the N-terminus and the C-terminus of the molecule, but otherwise the relaxation rates or the times are relatively uniform. But in case of clactosin, if we look at this region between the residues 65 and 75, which corresponds to this loop between the sheet number 3 and 4, we can see that it's clearly shows the elevated T2 relaxation times, which tells that there is a fast internal dynamics going on, most likely. And in the structure, we can see that this part is clearly more blurred than let's say, the helical or C part of the core of the protein. Whereas in case of twin filling, we can see that this part is relatively similar in the T2 values. And also, we can see that this loop here is much more rigid also when looking at the ensemble of structures. So this is just a, let's say, hawk-eye view on things that can be relatively easily probed without really going into or to quantify these motions. If you really want to go analyzing the relaxation data, the fast dynamics of the nanosecond motions, then you try to determine the order parameter S square. And this S square describes the spatial restriction of internal motion. It's so-called model-free analysis developed by Libari and Sabo in 1982, which basically dissects two motions. There's an overall rotation or tumbling of the molecule, and then there's this internal motion of particular residue. Or for instance, in this case, the amide proton, amide nitrogen spin pair. So if this S square value is close to zero, this movement of this individual residue, this bond vector, is it can move in the very large directory trajectory, so meaning that there's lot of high amplitude and non-restricted movement going on. But if this value is approaching one, then the cone or the movement is much more restricted, and it could be also so rigid that it's basically at the same frequency and the amplitude as the overall tumbling of the molecule. So it tells you at the residue-specific level that the, how much there can be movement of this bond vector and what is the time scale, or in the piconanosecond time scale window, that what is the time scale of this motion. So, like in this case, for again, for this Staphylococcus aureus, this one small enzyme, we can see on the link to the residue number and this S square values, and when we compare to the determined NMR structures, we can see that this loop between the first beta sheet and first alpha helix is clearly flexible in the structure. And we can see that it is actually flexible in piconanosecond time scale motion, because these values are clearly lower than the rest of the protein mostly. Of course, there are some additional small loops that approach the similar values, and of course in the termini we can see the similar motions. So this is just an example of quantifying these motions in piconanosecond time scale. Then I mentioned that there is very nice way of probing the slow dynamics in the micromillisecond time scale. And it's based on the fact that we can actually modify the frequency where we are applying the radio frequency pulses during the NMR experiments. So if there is an exchange phenomenon going on, let's say a two-side exchange between open and closed conformation, and if this conformational change is taking place on the time scale, which is slower by the rate we give these pulses, we can see that these pulses don't have an effect on the line width. But if we are increasing the rate of these pulses, we can see that we will actually get, we can dissect or separate this rate of exchange from the real T2 or R2, that is the transversal decay of magnetization altogether. So that then gives us information that on what micromillisecond time scale dynamics is taking place. Here is an example about this by David Case, group from Rutgers. Well, he studied protein C N-terminal domain of CAP protein, and which is binding the AMP. So with there are certain residues which are undergoing the dynamics, whether there is one AMP or two AMP molecules bound to this protein. And there's a conformational change taking from when these ligands are binding. And you can actually determine the rate of this exchange by using this this method of by changing the radio frequency of pulsing, so to say. And you can again on the residue level see that at what which part of the molecule that this slow dynamics is taking place, and then build those colors to your proteins for those residues. Okay, so the last part of this lecture, I will then talk about the molecular interactions, which especially the biologists find it most, let's say, interesting or fascinating even, what NMR can do to study the molecular interactions. And some motivation first for why you would like to study molecular interactions with NMR. So the ligand binding, for instance, that you have the target protein and you know that it binds some ligand, maybe why you would study that with NMR. First, once you have done the chemical shift assignment of your backbone, for instance, which can be done in a couple of days with the experienced spectroscopist, it's relatively fast method. You just take your ligand, put it titrate into your protein and measure how the signal is changing when you are adding the ligand. And it works for very weak interaction, let's say 10 millimolar or even weaker, or very tight interactions, the nanomolar or the picomolar. There is no lower limit or the upper limit of affinity, which you can determine. And it works for relatively small proteins, I mean 5 to 10 kilodaltons, or if you have the backbone assignment available, if you have a relatively large complex, you can even study that in certain limitations or restrictions. You can identify on the residue level or you can identify those residues which are involved in binding. And you can monitor very small changes in what are taking place when your ligand is binding. And one nice feature is that you do not require system-specific assays. You just titrate whatever you want to titrate to your, if it's in the soluble form, in a way. And this is also used for the so-called structure-activity relationships, SAR by NMR studies in the pharmaceutical industry. So what is the binding? It's the reversible chemical reaction as we know it. So we have the free protein, free ligand, they establish a complex which has an association and the dissociation rate. And how this is then connected to kinetics in a way, or the how we can determine the on the NMR timescale how strong is the binding. So if we take a simplistic example of chemical exchange, we discussed about this chemical exchange last lecture, but if we now consider that we take the protein, one millimolar protein and 500 micromolar ligand. Anyway, protein ligand ratio is like 1 to 0.5. Then half of the binding sites are saturated if we have the strong binding kind of. So if we look at this on the NMR time scale, we see the free protein here, and then the ligand bound form of the protein. If we are measuring the protein signals, for instance, we have the labeled protein and non-labeled ligand. So we see that they are in one-to-one ratio. There is a slow kinetics, slow in the NMR timescale, that we can separate the free protein and the complex form of the protein. But in the case of fast exchange, if the dissociation is fast, I mean the weak binding, like 50 micromolar or something like that instead of 50 nanomolar, we see the protein signals at the population weighted average of the chemical shift of free and bound forms. So that basically when we titrate our ligand in case of fast exchange or weak binding, we can see the peak moving from the free protein to the bound form of protein or fully saturated form of protein. So how we can determine or what method we are using seeing the binding and on what level we want to see the binding, it really depends on the protein that the information you want to get and the labeling or the possibilities for the labeling you have. So it depends on the dissociation, kinetics, size of the complex or the molecules, and if you have the isotope labeling available. So if you don't have labeled protein or ligand, you can still do these binding experiments by so-called saturation transfer difference experiment. I will show the example. Then highly similar, but quite different anyway, transferred NOE. I'm not going into the details. And then the diffusion the experiments, I'm not going to explain that either because of the limited time. Then if you have the labeled protein and unlabeled ligand, which is often the case if you are studying proteins, you can do the so-called chemical shift perturbation mapping. This is what we are doing, or you are doing in the first with Helena Aitio on Friday, and then this is what you are really about to do in the practicum. And then it's possible to also, in case of high affinity complex, you can measure the NOEs between the ligand and the protein. So intermolecular NOEs. Or you can use the cross-saturation experiments, but let's leave, I have a time for going through and these things. So unlabeled ligand and the target protein, you can use the saturation transfer difference NMR. So it's suitable for screening binding ligands when the protein is not labeled and the protein is large. The larger the protein, the better. So ligand or the amount of protein is very small, what is required. But the ligand you need typically 20 to 30 fold excess. So, but it can be 100-fold excess or even 1,000-fold excess. Then then the protein resonances are selectively saturated, so-called there's a saturation field, and this saturation will be transferred to the binding ligands. And we measure the difference between the reference and saturated spectrum. So here is a schematic presentation that we have a number of excess of ligands, and ligands are binding weakly to the protein. We saturate the protein, it saturates, the saturation is transferred to the ligand, and because of this fast kinetics going on, the saturation is spread among the ligands. So multiple ligands bind the target protein because of the fast kinetics, and weaker the binding, the stronger the saturation transfer signal. But if the off rate is low, the binding is very tight, well, one ligand is more or less bound there or stuck there for a long time, and this binding signal is or the saturation transfer difference signal is very small. So this is quite typically used for in the glycobiology or the enzymes or so that because we can easily saturate the methyl region of an enzyme. So here is a pure enzyme here, and then this is a pure NMR spectrum of a ligand. And then when we add the ligand to the enzyme and do the saturation and take the difference, we can see which part of the ligands or the ligand cocktail, if you have number of ligands there, which part of the ligand is bound to a protein. So it's quite neat way to actually you can do this kind of an epitope mapping, then if the ligand is larger, that which parts of the ligand are binding. You can determine the orientation of the binding using this method. But let's move now to the case where we have the unlabeled ligand, and then we have the nitrogen 15 or even double labeled target protein, the thing that you are doing on Friday. So this method is called chemical shift perturbation mapping. So it's based on the fact that there are binding induced changes in the chemical environment. We have the free protein here, the SH3 domain. It's not the same domain that you are using on Friday, but anyway, there is a binding site where the ligand shown here in the stick model is binding, and it induces the chemical shift changes to the residues which are at the binding site. And then of course less the chemical environment is less changing for these residues which are close far from the binding site. So we have the unlabeled ligand and then the labeled protein. We assign the protein that you might have the protein already available. Then you add the ligand in a stepwise manner. You monitor the proton-nitrogen correlation spectrum, which can be running in 5 to 10 minutes easily if you have a, let's say, 100 micromolar sample. And then you identify those resonances that shift upon the ligand binding, if we are talking about the fast kinetics. But if we are talking about slow kinetics, I mean the tight binding, it might be so that you need to reassign the resonances in the bound form, because you cannot follow the peak trajectories on the binding. So here is an example about this, that we have the follistatin or the FS1 domain of follistatin, which binds to sulfatated oligosaccharides or so. So if we start adding the ligand, so-called SOS molecule, to the sample, we can see that beige color or light brown color is the free form of protein. But we can easily see that when we start adding the ligand, some peaks start shifting clearly. Some shift quite a bit, and some are completely or more or less completely intact. Then we can set sort of a baseline here that we can, if we plot this on the residue scale, we can see that which residues are shifting the most. And those which are shifting the most are likely to be at the direct contact with the close proximity of the ligand. And then we can map those residues on the structure, if you have the structure available. Or if you are working only on the primary structure level, your structure determination is ongoing, you can then find those residues which are on the primary structure involved in binding. And this example here is for the fast kinetics. But if the kinetics is slow, the slow exchange that we have let's say nanomolar binding in a way, we can see that the free form and the bound form are existing, as I showed in the schematic data, that if we put the ligand and the protein in the ratio of 1 to 0.5, or the protein and ligand to 1 to 0.5, and there's a slow exchange, slow dissociation of the complex, we can see the bound form and the free form in the same spectrum. But we really cannot, probably we can guesstimate that this glycine is most likely, this is its bound form. But in case of, for example, these two glycines, we do not know that whether this is the bound form is of that one or it's that one. Most likely this tyrosine here, the bound form is here and so on, but we cannot be completely sure, especially in the crowded region of the spectrum, and it might require reassigning these peaks in the bound form. Here on the bottom part, we can see the presentation of this in a different way on the proton axis, that we have the free protein. Then we are approaching the 1 to 0.5 ratio, and we can see the free form and the bound form at the same time. And when we start adding more and more ligand, and when we are reaching the 1 to 1 ratio, then it's fully saturated and we don't see the free form of the protein at all. If we are in the fast exchange, the things are kind of easier, like in the previous slide, we can follow the trajectory of these peaks, that we can titrate the things, and we can see that this is the endpoint of that peak. And it's easy, it doesn't require the reassignment of peaks. This is kind of an exemplified for this one SA3 domain of this insulin receptor tyrosine kinase substrate with this pathogenic ESBFU from E. coli or the EHEC pathogen. We have this tryptophan here, which makes the binding affinity high, or something like 60 times higher than the cellular ligand. And we can see that the binding is slowly dissociating complex. When we take the EPS from the cellular protein, which contains the alanine here, otherwise the sequence is more or less the same or essentially from the binding structure point of view, here is the alanine instead of tryptophan. We can see already that, well, there is a fast dissociation because we can follow these peak trajectories quite nicely. And it makes things easier to see that which is the bound form and which is the free form. Yet, or in addition to that, we can identify still that the same residues involved in binding of this pathogen are involved in binding of this cellular ligand. It's the same residues are basically shifting, but the dissociation is just faster. So it's easy to compare the on the residue level what is happening with your ligand A and your ligand B, so to say. And in this way, if you are doing this shift mapping, you can then find, if you do not make the complex structure, you can map the binding sites at which our residues are shifting mostly, and you can make the structure of the protein in the bound form, or start doing the mutations for those residues which seem to be important for the binding, for instance. If you want to determine the structure of the protein ligand complexes, then you need to have strong enough binding. Of course, those weak binding complexes structures can be done also, but then you need to be able to saturate the protein with the ligand enough. But typically this is like, when strong binding, we are talking about when binding is less than 10 micromolar, or some, the KD is smaller than 10 micromolar, or so. The same holds true, you need the unlabeled ligand, you have the labeled protein, then you can measure with certain isotope filter experiments. You can measure the intramolecular NOEs coming from labeled part to the labeled part within a protein, no way. And then you measure the intramolecular ligand NOEs from unlabeled part to unlabeled part. There are certain kind of NMR experiments that you can design to that end. And then finally, you measure this anchoring NOEs, the intermolecular NOEs, which are coming from the labeled part to unlabeled part, so between the ligand and the protein. And in this way, you can build the complex structure. In some cases, you want to do this in the other way around, that you have the unlabeled protein and the labeled peptide or so on, do the same thing. And then you get the structure like here for this IRTKS SS3 complex with ESP FU. So ESP FU conformation is shown here on red, and then on blue there is the SS3 domain, and this green sticks here, so the intermolecular NOEs, which they were the strongest intermolecular NOEs, which we determined to be 145, so the anchoring restraints that anchor this peptide on the surface of this SS3 domain. So then This is used also, this technique, for the structure activity relationship studies by NMR. This was done in the Abbott laboratories by Stephen Fezzik's group 20 years ago already. So that we take the target protein, then we take a ligand or the cocktail of ligands, and we add these ligands to the protein, and if they are binding, we can see that there's a peak shifting because of the ligand, and if not, we can see the intact free protein spectrum, or the nitrogen protein correlation spectrum. And then the next phase, we can screen or make the optimized the first ligand and get the binding stronger, and then optimize the second ligand and maybe then link the ligands together and make the binding affinity much higher than with, let's say, the lead molecule, which could be a millimolar binding, but we are ending up being in the nanomolar binder here. Yeah, at the end of this process. Finally, I want to say a couple of things about the specific things that you can do nowadays, is that you measure the pKa's for the histidines or any ionic group, that you can just do the pH titration following the Anderson Hasselblad equation, and you can determine that what is the pKa value of certain ionizable group in your side chain of, for example, like in case of histidine here, or glutamate or arginase and so on. You can determine the tautomeric state of the histidine, that which nitrogen is attached by the proton. Is it the delta or the epsilon? Because they give the different kind of peak patterns, whether there are proton in both epsilon and delta, or only in epsilon or in delta. And those can be studied also at the different pH, that what is the case, and it's important for the enzymatic action, for instance. And I already mentioned that here is an example showing the lysine pKa value determination in the GB1 protein, that you can determine the pKa values and whether these are involved in the salt bridge. So whether there's a proton or there's no proton in the lysine side chain. Or you can do the NMR inside the living cell, for instance, that you have the protein in vitro or in the NMR tube, so to say, or you put the protein inside the living cell and the structure changes, and whether it's stable over the time within the cell or in vitro. So this is also possible, although not straightforward technique today. It requires some skills to do, but anyway, it's completely possible to do high resolution NMR inside studies. Okay, so that's all, folks, as they say, what I have to say about this.